Welcome to On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Reinel with Paul Steinhauser. This is the show that's all about the First Nation presidential primary and New Hampshire politics. And it's presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, caring for those who care for you. For information, check out nhhca.org. Once again, an incredibly busy week and weekend here in the First Nation presidential primary. A lot of news to discuss. Beto O'Rourke is in. Joe Biden is close to getting in. Bernie Sanders here this past weekend. Paul was with him on Sunday as he was in Concord. And we'll talk about Bernie being back in the 603 and a rising star in the primary process. Pete Buttigieg joins us here on the program as he was in New Hampshire this past week. A lot to discuss, Paul, but I guess we'll start with Beto and him getting into the race, announcing such via a local television station for him in El Paso. And then the next morning, he's in Iowa.
Yeah, putting out a video as well, 6 a.m. Thursday morning, putting out that video that went nationwide with him launching. It also came about 24 hours after an interesting piece in Vanity Fair, which just seemed to me that was kind of fawning all over Beto O'Rourke, where he tried to explain why he's running. I don't know how good a job he did. He wants to be part of it, Chris. He just wants to be part of it. That's what he said. Beto's in. Beto O'Rourke's in. Now we stand at 15 candidates, either declaring their candidacy or at the least launching presidential exploratory committees. I think we'll be up to close to about 20 when we're all said and done, because we've got a couple of others that are about to get in or seriously thinking about it. And to those reporters who wrote the death of the New Hampshire primary was near, I think you got that one wrong. This weekend alone, we'll have nine people either launching candidates or considering running for the White House will be here in New Hampshire. So the New Hampshire primary is far from dead.
Yeah, Beto's candidacy is interesting for a number of reasons. And one of them is, you know, this process which led to him announcing, where he, you know, was seemingly kind of soul searching and trying to find a reason, you know, to run and determining whether it was what he wanted to do. And he comes out of it and it's like, okay, I'm still not, you know, fiery, and I still don't have this fire in the belly, it would appear, to be president of the United States, mm-hmm. but I want to be a part of the process. And from, you know, each candidate, successful candidate that we have seen come through this primary, they may be really nice people, but they all are competitive and have a strong edge to them, a burning desire to be president, to compete. And, you know, whether it was somebody like Bob Dole or John McCain or Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, there is a toughness and an edge to them. And we haven't seen Beto yet here in New Hampshire. We haven't talked with him. I've just seen him speak. And, you know, he seems like a very thoughtful, nice guy. And, you know, politics perhaps could use somebody like that. And I think that a lot of individuals are, you know, liking him because of that and want to see him get into the race and want to see a niceness and a caring aspect to politics. But I don't know how that's going to play. Like, even you look at individuals like Martin Luther King Jr. and some of our leaders and historic figures, there was this toughness and this grittiness to them. And again, we'll see how it plays out, but I'm not sure Beto has that.
No, it's a question a lot of people are asking. Listen, Beto O'Rourke became a rock star in the Democratic Party, so much so that he's known just by his first name, Beto. You don't get that very often. I think Madonna, and I think Bernie in politics, Bernie, right? Okay, maybe Joe Biden, Joe. But he reached a stature very quickly. He went from a nobody. Nobody knew him outside of his district to a national stature because he raised an eye-popping $80 million, most of it small-dollar donations online, in his bid, his nearly successful bid to oust Republican conservative Senator Ted Cruz from the U.S. Senate. But then,
And he's running against somebody in that spot, too. Somebody who's very unpopular. It's one candidate. And
it's a very different
situation. He's an underdog in that spot.
Yeah, it's a very different situation. I wrote a piece for Fox News earlier this week asking whether he missed his moment, too, because, you know, Beto fever was at fever pitch back in December and January. You know, should he have announced then rather than this long, drawn out searching his soul, going across the country with so many teases, yeah, including an interview on Oprah? Then at the end of February, he said, "I'd made up my mind." But he didn't say what it was. He went to South by Southwest, where he knew the media would be, the national media would be, and he still didn't reveal. So he's known for a couple of weeks, but he's just teased this thing on and on. I don't know. Maybe I still think his supporters will love him. Right. And there's a supporter of his right here in New Hampshire, right a couple blocks away, Jay Sernikowski, who's just overjoyed today. But we'll see if it plays. It's still too early to say.
And I think, you know, the individual who's up next here on the program, Pete Buttigieg, I think that you look at him and you look at the two side by side, and you know both are young, although Buttigieg actually is 10 years younger than Beto O'Rourke, and you see him lay out clearly and cohesively with conviction and dedication what he wants to do and why he wants to be president of the United States. And you listen to Cory Booker speak, and you see the other candidates, Kirsten Gillibrand, and the way that she presents, Kamala Harris, the way she presents, the individuals who represent the future of the Democratic Party, all, in my view, are a more complete package than Beto O'Rourke is at this point. You see glimpses of a lot of the individuals he gets compared to, like Robert Kennedy.
Who he looks a little bit like, I guess.
Right,
say,
yeah. And Barack Obama. You see glimpses of that, but there is not a clear, cohesive package, and he does not have the fire and the burning desire to compete like Barack Obama.
He's not the orator
and Robert Kennedy
Obama
had, and he's not the orator
or
that
the Cory Booker
Obama
is. So
or Cory Booker, and these are also individuals that are highly competitive and work their tails off. Cory Booker's schedule, Kirsten Gillibrand's schedule. I mean, this is going to be a different type of race for him, and you know he's going up against two hugely successful name brand politicians as well in Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders.
It is an uphill climb. He does have name recognition. You saw that in the public opinion polls in the race for Democratic presidential nomination the last couple months. So his numbers have been fading a little
bit
over the
last month. But
name
recognition versus acknowledgement and understanding of who the individual is. People know his. It's a different name. Mm-hmm. He has the name ID, Beto O'Rourke. You mentioned
Beto.
First
Everybody
name.
Beto. Everybody knows him, Beto.
Beto. They know him. But do they know him? Have they seen him?
No, they don't.
Have they seen him speak? Are
Most
they
don't.
Do they know his background? So that, I think, is different than Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders. You know Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders.
Sure.
You have likely seen you've seen Cory Booker or Kamala Harris question somebody in front of a committee in Congress. Beto, you've seen pictures probably, but have you seen him interviewed? Have you seen him give a speech if you're a low to medium information New Hampshire primary voter? So the process of getting to know exactly who he is as well, is he going to be able to meet the hype, or is he going to fall short of the hype and not have that it factor, which leads to more intrigue rather than less intrigue?
Somebody who doesn't have the it factor but who's starting to get it is Pete Buttigieg.
Yes.
He just made a second trip here to New Hampshire. Did Politics and X. So he got the big platform, right, that any candidate wants when you come to New Hampshire. I was there for that. I got to say, he was so smooth, so polished, for only 37 years old. Guy's 40 years younger than Bernie Sanders. I was impressed, but more importantly than me, people in the audience were very impressed.
Was and, not alive when Bernie Sanders was his age.
Yeah, good point. That's a very good point. You know, then he took questions from the media assembled there. And again, very polished. I asked him about, and it was interesting, he never once mentioned the name Donald Trump in the more than an hour long speech and then question and answer with the audience at Politics Next. So I asked him, why not? Take a listen to what he said.
Mr. Mayor, one name you didn't bring up today, and it was kind of interesting, was the guy in the White House, Donald Trump. You never mentioned him by name. I'm wondering why.
Because I don't think the election is about him. I mean, look, when he does something wrong, we'll confront it. When he says something that's a lie, we will correct it. But at the end of the day, if all we're talking about is him, folks in communities like mine and around here will be saying, okay, but nobody's talking about us. We got to make sure that we're talking about the issues that people care about. We got to make sure we're talking about, you know, how we're going to respond to change coming to our economy. On a day like today, we got to be talking International Women's Day, and there's not nearly enough being done to secure paid family leave, reproductive freedom, to deal with pay transparency issues. These are the things that actually affect whether our lives will go better or worse. And the biggest message I have to the current president is, it's not about you.
But a lot of your rivals for the nomination, if you do run, have no problem mentioning his name. Are they wrong to do that? They bring it up a lot.
I just think that in addition to responding to the current moment and the current president, we need to be talking about what the next era is going to look like. This president will come and go. This presidency will come and go. And frankly, I think with the condition of our politics and our economy today, if it wasn't him, it'd be somebody else like him until we deal with the issues of which he is a symptom. So, of course, we'll confront him, we'll call him out, we'll beat him. But at the end of the day, it's not about him. It's about us.
Mayor.
Interesting answer. And here's the thing. I posted that soundbite online. Within a day and a half, it got 50,000 clicks, which for me is a lot. Mm-hmm. And then a couple days later, he goes on CNN and does that town hall. Instantly raises a boatload of cash. I tell you, Pete Buttigieg, he's a man on the rise.
No, I agree. I mean, I don't know where he's going to rise to. But, you know, as I reference in the conversation with him, you see and feel something is happening there. And, you know, particularly after the CNN town hall, where on a national stage, where this is really his first opportunity to present himself on a national stage, he nails it. And that's something that's very rare to see. And again, that's that aspect of having, you know, a command of yourself and a fire to want to succeed, you know, to in that format to meet the moment. So you mentioned the it factor. To me, he may not have that right now in terms of people understanding it and knowing it, but he has that. If you're able to step into that moment at 37 years of age, which is the same age as I am, and you're able to command the stage in that instance, that's big. So I think that he is definitely someone to watch. Cory Booker is back here this weekend. Have you been surprised at all that his poll numbers haven't risen more? Because it seems like there's a disconnect between what's happening at the events and what people are saying at the events, who particularly individuals who are going to multiple events, you know, what they feel about him and his staff versus what we're seeing in the public polling data here in New Hampshire. Feels like he should be doing a little bit better in terms of the numbers than he is.
I think that's a great point, because he really, when you see him in person, boy, wow, you're wowed. The people that really come out of that feeling like they like this guy. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that a couple times now at events he's done. But it's not translating yet to polls. It's early. You know, I don't think we should put a lot of credence in these early polls. They're based on name ID. And that's why you saw Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden at the top, and Beto, who got some big name ID.
But I also think that Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden have really a chance to finish at the top. So, I mean, maybe the numbers of the individuals will rise who are not as well known. Mm-hmm. But I think that name ID is, to a large degree, you know, New Hampshire is supposed to be different. But I think that when all is said and done, I would not bet against Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders being one and two. I have guaranteed that Joe Biden, if he gets into this race, will finish second. At least
guaranteed
second.
Right here. You heard
guaranteed.
It first. Right
guaranteed.
Here?
Not a Patrick Ewing guarantee, boys and girls, which never happens.
Hey, as a Knicks fan,
Mark Messier type of guarantee.
Oh, and John Stark missed those shots, those three-pointers. Don't bring it back.
The ball is still bouncing up in game 7 of the 94. That's where we're 25 years removed from that.
I was 2 years old at the time.
I was not 2 years old at the time. So we always need a little bit of a New York Knicks reference here on the on-background program.
What's the program with
I think that he's Joe Biden, if he gets in this race, given how the dynamic, the lanes that are emerging, where everyone is moving at this point, his name ID, and the independent voter factor. I mean, Joe Biden, in my view, is a lock to finish one or two in the New Hampshire primary. And Bernie Sanders, he's almost a lock to finish one or two also. So then what does that mean for Elizabeth Warren? What does
that's
mean
the problem,
for the
because
others?
There's two people that need to win the primary.
Right.
And Joe Biden is not one of them. He's got to finish top three, four, but he doesn't have to win it. Yeah, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren both have to win it. And that's going to be a problem for Warren. But she's working hard in the state. She's got a strong organization. She's going to make a lot of trips here. She already has.
Yeah.
She's been here more than any other of the contenders the first three months of the year. So we will see plenty more of her.
And she's made a lot of news in this campaign with policy.
A lot of policy.
And, you know, most recently, pushing forth the idea of creating a regulatory environment that will break up Amazon, Facebook, and I believe it was Google the third.
Mm-hmm.
So she has been extremely aggressive in regards to policy, and even if she does not win or have success, she is setting the debate and what the policy discussion is going to be for this. Because when Elizabeth Warren says, we're going to break up Google, we're going to break up Facebook and Amazon, then reporters like us want
to
know, Cory Booker, what do you think about that?
Exactly.
Joe Biden, what do you think about that? Has Facebook gotten too big? And I think that this is going to be an interesting primary to see where the policy heads. And Elizabeth Warren is planting her flag in regards to policy, and I think that's significant.
Yeah, when she came up here to New Hampshire, she talked about child care. That was a big at her speech at the New Hampshire Democratic Party's big winter and spring fundraising dinner. She really emphasized her new policy on child care, universal pre-K, and she has really been adding to the discourse, which is nice. Let's go back to Biden for a second. I don't think it's a matter of if anymore. It's a matter of when.
Yeah.
He made it pretty clear earlier this week when he keynoted the speech in Washington, D.C. to the International Association of Firefighters that he was running. It's clear he is going to run. It's just a matter of when. It's probably going to be in early April. And, he's in it. So who else is left? We got a couple others. Eric Swalwell, the congressman from California, we've seen a couple times. He's probably getting in. Seth Moulton looks like he's going to get back. He's getting in. He's coming here to New Hampshire this weekend. He's going to be in Iowa soon after. Tim Ryan, the congressman from Ohio, looks like he's probably, I'd say it's pretty clear he's about to get in. And there are a few others. Bill de Blasio. This is a surprise.
Yeah.
Now, de Blasio's coming up here this weekend. He's also just been to Iowa and South Carolina. Very progressive. Yeah, he might jump in. Stacey Abrams.
Yeah.
She just said this week at South by Southwest that she may jump in. And then there's Michael Bennett, who we're going to hear from a little bit later.
So that's 20.
Yeah, we're going to be there at 20. I think right around 20.
Yeah, so
exactly.
As you mentioned, we're at 15 right now. Then you add Biden, then you have the two congressmen, and de Blasio, 19, and Abramson, 20, and 20, Bennett's 21.
21, yeah. Abrams, we'll see. I'm not convinced about her. The other one I'm not convinced about who's been flirting with it is Terry McAuliffe, the former governor of Virginia.
He's been quiet lately.
Yeah, and with Biden like all but certain to get in, I think his lane is closed. He was going to get in if Biden didn't get in, but yeah. All right, 20, is that enough?
I think that's more than enough.
Okay, good.
I think, what's going to be interesting about Biden's candidacy, too, is how he's going to bridge the gap between the past and the future. And, watching that speech, I sense that he is going to have a make America great again, for lack of a better term, type of approach to this, where he wants to return America to the ideals and the foundation of what the Democratic Party used to be and what the country used to be, where individuals worked together, had a commonality of cause and belief in our nation. So he is going to have that aspect of the campaign, but it's also be very important for him to lay out where he's going to take the country to. And I think that an area where he can have success, particularly in rural America, is in regards to infrastructure, where President Trump has not delivered what he promised in regards to infrastructure.
Good point.
And, you go to rural America and talk about a 21st century job plan, which includes broadband, traditional infrastructure, rail, and things of that nature, and putting people to work and creating opportunity and transferring a lot of the jobs of the present and the past into more technology jobs. And that's an economic plan that picks up where Trump left off and was unable to fulfill, gets success on two levels. A, you point out the fact the president didn't deliver, and B, you're able to make a pitch to rural voters.
Yeah, no, I could see that be an issue that he would wrap his hands around, especially it's an issue that really plays well with his working class union base. a base that he really needs to generate excitement with, because he's probably not going to get a lot of the millennials. He's not going to. We'll see how he does with minority voters who play such a huge role in the Democratic Party. And then there's his age, of course, which will be a factor, even more so for him, I think, than for Bernie Sanders, even though Sanders is a year older than him. So Joe Biden's name puts him right at the top right away. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people say the best day of his campaign is going to be the first day of his campaign. We'll see. He's going to go a long way because of his name, but he needs to do more than just his name.
Question two is whether or not President Obama throws his full support behind Joe Biden.
Yeah, you know, the president's going to, if he endorses before the end of the primaries, it's going to be the most important, obviously, endorsement in the Democratic Party. You would assume that Joe Biden will be right there at the top, but he doesn't. It's not clear that he would endorse. I don't know. Barack Obama's going to be in a curious situation, no doubt.
That is Paul Steinhauser. I am Chris Ryan. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. When we return, conversation with Pete Buttigieg. Then after that, Chris Sununu doing a bit of an about-face in regards to whether or not he is going to run for the U.S. Senate seat currently held by Gene Shaheen and create a dream matchup for political junkies featuring himself and the sitting U.S. senator. We'll return with more On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Welcome back. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. Well, I was down at spring training this past week covering the Red Sox for our New Hampshire Now program. But during that time period, I was joined over the phone by an individual who's creating a lot of excitement here in New Hampshire, as well as across the country. His name is Pete Buttigieg. He's joined us before. He is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and has continued to draw bigger and bigger crowds and more interest. We talked about that in this phone conversation.
So welcome an individual who's opened up a lot of eyes both in New Hampshire and across the country as he continues in the exploratory phase of running for president. He is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg. Pete, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Great. Appreciate you joining us for the show. So I'm curious as to what the last few days have been like for you after a really strong trip to New Hampshire. Heard a lot of positive things after your politics and eggs speech, and then town hall meeting on CNN, which drew rave reviews as well. What has the interest been like, and what have you noticed in terms of a spike in interest in your candidacy?
I've got to tell you, the interest really exploded just in the last couple of days, especially after the CNN town hall. It's funny, when you go out on the trail, you start feeling like you're repeating yourself all the time, and then you have a moment that reminds you that most people still haven't heard your message at all. And so the town hall was a great chance to get in front of a lot of new people, and the good news is folks seem to like what they saw. Same during our last visit to New Hampshire, we spoke to a number of different audiences, I think for the most part, introducing ourselves for the first time, and the response is just extremely encouraging.
That's one thing you'll notice during the course of the long campaign is, particularly in New Hampshire, where there is late deciding voters who will decide literally the last week of the campaign, and so it all starts again, during that time period. But there's a lot of repetition, but I think that, your story is resonating with folks. The narrative is resonating with folks. And also, there is a strong urge to have new leadership and to have young leadership and to go in a different direction than we have gone in the past. You see that in regards to the interest in Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in Congress. And is that the sense that you're getting, where perhaps in the past a 37-year-old running for president was not something that we thought of, but now there is this thirst for, okay, we just need to hand off kind of a generational torch?
Yeah, there's clearly something about this moment. I mean, I can't think of any other time in American history when somebody like me would have been taken seriously at all. But we're clearly in this unusual moment, and we're also clearly at a stage where I think that generational angle is a big advantage. And it's not just with young voters. I mean, I certainly love seeing the student turnout and the number of young people who've come out. But it's also a lot of folks my parents' age who are really curious, really interested to hear a new message and to see a new kind of messenger. And that is just a consistent pattern of the excitement people seem to have about that. And it ties into a message where I'm talking a lot about how the world looks to you when you're, for example, trying personally to prepare for what the world might be like in 2054 when I get to the current age of the current president. It makes some of these questions that are being talked about like they're someone else's problem. You know, what climate change means for the future, and how we're going to pay for the tax cuts for the wealthiest that happened a couple of years ago. And it puts them into perspective as a personal issue. And I think people want to know what leaders from a new generation have to say about that.
And I think from our generation, we're the same age. I think there is also a feeling amongst ourselves and the individuals we went to school with and younger that the challenge of trying to live the life that your parents lived is a real one. And you're wondering what the life for your kids is going to be like as a result of that and economic instability, the amount of debt that surrounds us. So how do you go about facing those challenges, which is one of the big reasons that you see, in my view, a rise in interest in socialism and how that polls amongst individuals of the low Generation X and millennials. How do you go about that challenge of individuals of our age have set that bar for what they want their life to be like in terms of income, and hitting that is difficult?
Well, I think a lot of it's based on this very American expectation that we all ought to be able to enjoy a lifestyle that's as good or better than our parents.
Correct.
And that used to be something you could almost take for granted. I mean, as long as you didn't do anything wrong, you could pretty much expect over the course of your life, you would come out ahead. And we're on track to be perhaps the first generation where that's not true, the first generation not to do better than those who came before us. And when that changes, everything else changes too. I actually believe that it is possible for capitalism to deliver that, but only if it's happening within a framework of a consistent, fair set of rules and a rule of law under our democracy that makes sure that the excesses of the system are under control and that concentrations of wealth don't turn into concentrations of power. If we lose that, then I think it's very hard to get ahead. And we see it play out in student debt. We see it play out in the job insecurity that our generation faces. And then you have that colliding with these forces related to technology, right? I mean, because of what automation is doing to change the workplace, people my age and younger are going to change careers. More frequently than people my parents' age or older change jobs. Now, this isn't just something to shake our heads over and feel upset about. It's something that we can act on, but it starts by, leaving aside the president's promise that we can somehow just stop change and turn back the clock, mm-hmm. and instead ask how we can make these changes that are accelerating really work for us, get on top of them, master them, which has always been what America did best.
I think that's a key point, and meeting the technology infrastructure changes and finding out where the niche is in regards to succeeding with those particular niches and finding economic growth there. That's Pete Buttigieg joining us here on the New Hampshire Now program. I am Chris Ryan. This hour of the show is presented by ARP New Hampshire as well as New England College, and this segment of the program brought to you by PNN Automotive. I'm somewhat hesitant to ask this question because, in my view, true equality is when things happen and there's no need for a question of this nature. And whether it was with having an all-female delegation in New Hampshire for the first time and the significance of that, or for you, running for president, being the first openly gay individual to look at running for president, you're still in the exploratory phase. I'm interested in your views on equality and the historic nature of your candidacy in that sense, where, again, in my view, equality is when there is nothing extraordinary in regards to this, and that it is there is no pushback, and it is looked at as something that is very American, in my view.
Well, I think that's right. When we truly hit the level of equality that I'm hoping for, then it won't even be newsworthy or considered particularly interesting.
Correct.
But I got to say, in a lot of discussions about policy and some interviews, it doesn't even come up, and that's historic in its own way. But I also recognize that there is a historic quality to trying to do this, simply because it hasn't been done before. There's not been an out elected official seeking this office. And so now I'm mindful of what it means, what it would have meant to me as a kid growing up to see that. And the main way I think about it is that it, if nothing else, will hopefully make it a little bit easier and a little bit less remarkable for the next person who comes along.
It's a very, really good answer to that question. And do you think that there will be a change in how some individuals view that type of historic candidacy? moving forward, and at a common everyday level. Because one of the things about Barack Obama's presidency is that we saw what we thought was a glass ceiling, which was broken through. But then with a lot of the ugliness regarding Donald Trump's presidency, it seemed that there was a permeation of hate, which has continued to ensue at the the grassroots level, which really has to be dealt with in terms of bringing this country back together.
You know, sometimes the way our country works is it's three steps forward and then two steps back.
Right.
I do think that the last few years have unleashed some demons, especially when it comes to race, that we may have mistakenly believed we're already conquered. And it's a you know, if nothing else, a call to be vigilant and to remember that these forms of intolerance can rear their ugly head any time. And I'm aware that I'm part of that change, but I also think that one thing that really brings out the best in us is when we understand each other as people. And that's, you know, whether you have a relative or a neighbor or whether it's a public figure that you're just getting to know through kind of through the news or even through the political process. Anything that helps us understand people in categories and from backgrounds different than our own, not through the lens of those categories, but just as people. I think that makes us all more understanding, and I think it's the way toward a better society.
Yeah, tolerance is created via that venue. I completely believe in that because individuals are, you know, very much in their own silo at times and will have their own preconceived notions in regards to who people are and how they act. And then when those notions are challenged, then with information and education, then, you know, true equality can present itself. Final thing, as I mentioned, you are in the exploratory phase in running for president. Is there a timetable for when you're going to be full on running for president of the United States, and or is it basically just a matter of categories at this point in time, and you are in fact running?
Yeah, you know, when we first set up the committee, of course, we wanted to see what the response would be, how folks would respond in the early states, what our fundraising might look like, how the organization would shake out. Now, I think we've had just about every one of those questions answered. The response has been off the charts on the ground, especially for somebody who's not famous on day one. I mean, we had an event in Portsmouth that was supposed to be a meet and greet, and I got there, and it was more like a rally. 300-400 people there, which was really encouraging. And ever since Sunday night CNN town hall performance, we've seen so many people go to eatforamerica.com and help kick in to help us get that individual donor count that would get us invited to the DNC debate. So all the signs are pointing in the right direction. But when it comes to a full-on announcement and launch, you know, that's something you only get to do once. And so we want to make sure we're completely prepared, and we'll take a little more time making sure that everything's in order before we're ready to take that step.
Appreciate joining us for the program. It's been fun to see the rise of your presidential candidacy, and it's one of those cool aspects of the early primary process where individuals who are not well known can, but are extremely talented and have a great background and story, can rise to the forefront. And I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Well, thank you. Look forward to it, and enjoy being back out there on the trail soon.
That is Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, who continues to draw intrigue and interest. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Welcome back. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Reinhold with Paul Steinhauser. Well, Chris Sununu has been very clear in the past about the fact that he was not going to run for U.S. Senate, and that changed yesterday on Jack Heath's show.
That's right. Our good friend Jack Heath having the governor on, the two-term Republican governor here in New Hampshire. Take a listen to what happened when Jack asked him about the possibility of launching a Republican challenge against Democratic Senator Gene Shaheen.
Is that a thought is even entered your mind in terms of running for Senate?
Well, we've had a lot of people ask, to be sure. And again, Mike, I'm going to kind of stick with the answer I've given because the ultimate truth is the only Democrats I'm worried about defeating right now are those trying to impose, you know, massive taxes on the people of New Hampshire.
But have you ruled that possibility out, I'm asking?
I don't rule anything out.
So we asked him about this back in June, on June the 14th, at the airport diner, and this is what he had to say at that point.
Are you ruling out completely that you would still, that you would run for Senate?
Maybe all three of us should run. Me, my brother, and Kelly, all in a three-way primary. That would be awesome.
We'll throw Gordon Humphrey in there, too.
Scott Brown might be back from New Zealand. No, I have absolutely no interest. Look, I'm a manager. I love to manage. I'm a CEO. I love to build systems, see how they work, be able to tweak them, help folks feel inspired to become part of the process, build good teams. That's my skill set. None of those skills really apply to Washington. They fund money and they talk about headlines. That's not what I do. I'm a manager and I implement. And again, we've had such success here. I want to keep it going.
So after he said what he said on Jack Heath's show, which was definitely different than what he told us back in June and what he has repeatedly said ever since last June.
I have zero interest. No bingo, interest. Bingo. No interest at all.
He's not a legislator. He's an executive. That's right. What he kept saying. He had an avail with reporters after the executive council meeting. And near the end of it, I was able to chime in and start asking some questions. And I asked him about what he said on Jack Heath. He, again, repeated the line that he's taken nothing off. Everything's on the table, right? He's not ruling anything out. He also said that right now, used the words right now, he's not considering a run. But he used, again, the words right now. He said that any kind of decision would probably come well after, you know, after the legislative session is over, the budget's done. He said he's not thinking about it right now. Then I asked him, and Adam Sexton as well, I asked him about those two recent polls that indicated a hypothetical matchup between him and Shaheen, who's running for a third term in the Senate. It would pretty much be all tied up. And the governor took the opportunity to blast Gene Shaheen. He said, quote unquote, "I think the mandate is very clear. They," meaning the people of New Hampshire, "want someone other than Gene Shaheen, whether it's myself or another candidate. Here's the money line. She's very vulnerable." Boom. I guess he's getting even for her because she really ripped into him at the Democratic Party's big fundraising dinner last month. But he had his comments and they were juicy.
Yeah, I don't know why she did that. It seemed as though she was almost baiting him to get into this race. And she may have that come to fruition because, in my view, you look at the way this is developing, mm-hmm. Chris Sununu is moving towards running for the U.S. Senate. I'm not saying he's going to run.
He's opened the door.
But I'm saying he is moving towards running for the U.S. Senate. And I think that that's very clear. I talked to Jeb Bradley about that, and also what happens if Chris Sununu does run. Who would run for governor, and would it be Jeb?
I think he'd make a great senator. He's been a great governor. I think Gene Shaheen will be a tough, tall challenge, if you will, for any Republican. But I think that, you know, there are two potential Republicans that I think would stand a pretty good chance to be very competitive. Chris is one, and Kelly Ayotte is the other. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, I think Chris has done a great job as governor. I haven't agreed with him, you know, on everything, biomass in particular, but I think overall I give him an A-plus for what he's done. The economy is very strong. We are solving problems in terms of opioid abuse, mental health, the Division of Children, Youth, and Family, which protects kids from abuse and neglect, was terrible under former Governor Hassan. So I think, you know, Chris's leadership has really been great.
If Governor Sununu does not run for re-election, would you run for governor?
No. I've crossed that bridge a few times, and people have asked me to run for Congress, and I flirted, you know, in 2014 with that idea again. People wanted me to run in 2016 for governor. I flirted with that. You know what? I'm pretty happy with what I'm doing, where I am, and the answer is no.
There you go. That's even more emphatic than Governor Sununu saying he was going to run for Senate. So we'll take that as a no.
I like my life right now.
Right.
I remember what it was like, you know, when I was in Congress. And your life's not your own. And I've been there. I've done that. I've kind of found a way to, I think, be able to do the job that I do, and hopefully I do it well. and I get to, you know, spend my weekends in the mountains,
right,
or, you know, doing other things. And I just, that's pretty important to me now, too. I'm not, I love the job I'm doing, but I would not want it to be a seven-day-a-week job the way being governor or running for Congress is. It's just, been there, done that, and...
All right, Jeb Bradley right there. You know what would be interesting? If Kelly Ayotte were, and again, this is pure speculation, if Kelly Ayotte were to run for governor and Chris Sununu were to run for Senate, that would be a dream ticket for Republicans to make them competitive in both races, no?
It would be a dream ticket, but it's never going to happen. I think if Ayotte runs for anything again, it's going to be for the U.S. Senate. It's not going to be for governor. And she's not going to run for the U.S. Senate in 2020 if Donald Trump remains on the ballot. Now, if perchance Donald Trump, for whatever reason, isn't on the ballot, then it's a different story. But I think it's much more likely that Ayotte runs in 2022 when she would have the rematch with Maggie Hassan, who ousted her from the office back in 2016. But you make a good point. Having Sununu on the ballot is either as senator or governor is crucial for Republicans if they want to do well here in New Hampshire and try to win back either House or the State House this next year.
This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association.
Welcome back to On Background, the program that's all about New Hampshire politics and is brought to you by our good friends at the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. We had Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado in the state a couple days back. He is seriously weighing a bid for the White House. He's been making the trips to the early states. And while he was here, I had a chance to sit down with him on Elm Street in downtown Manchester about a bunch of topics. Take a listen. You were just in Iowa last month. Now you're here in New Hampshire. What's your timetable?
What's my timetable?
Your timetable for deciding on this?
Well, I think weeks, not months, certainly.
And what are going to be the deciding factors to say, yeah, I'm going to do this, or no, I'm going to stay in the Senate?
I think two things. One, that my family is okay with me doing it, and they seem to be okay with me doing it. In the case of my 14-year-old, I think that's because she actually sees it as an opportunity for me to be away from her. But I also, I need to know that there's a real opportunity for me to make a difference in the race and that I could have a chance to win the race. That's what I'm trying to figure out. And I'm inclined to do that.
All right, so we got six U.S. senators already in the race. Some
is that
of them,
how many?
Yeah,
and counting. No wonder we can't get anything done.
We lost two this week with Merkley and Sherrod Brown, but that's still true. Six in there, some with more name recognition, some with bigger bank accounts. If you jump in, how does a Michael Bennett compete with that?
I would say probably almost all with more name recognition, almost all with bigger bank accounts.
I was being kind.
But, well, you don't need to be kind. It's true. I mean, anybody looking at this can see it.
So how do you compete?
Look, here's what we know. Virtually never do we predict who's going to win the Democratic nomination for the presidency, and virtually never do we know who's going to be elected president. That's what this process is meant to be about. We're at the starting line of what's going to be a crucible that is going to determine who the person is that has the best chance of taking on Donald Trump, and I would say beyond that, who's somebody who can help restore governance to this country again. And we don't know the answer to that right now. I mean, I think that that's what the process will determine for us.
Your old boss, when you were in mayor, your old boss, the mayor,
yeah,
and then the governor is now in the race.
Right.
Does the country need two candidates from Colorado?
Well, I don't think two candidates from Colorado are a bad thing at all. I love John Hickenlooper. He's a good friend of mine, and I think he's done a great job as governor, did a great job as mayor, and he'll be a great candidate. We're very different people. We've had very different experiences. And I think we bring different perspectives to the work. So we'll see how that all ends up.
One of the big stories this week, not in your chamber, but right next door in the U.S. House, obviously was the Democrats trying to figure out on the resolution with Congresswoman Omar. Some are saying it was a watered-down resolution. Are you comfortable with what they passed?
Well, look, I'm not in the House. I'm comfortable with what they passed. I think that what she said was something that shouldn't be said. My mom and her parents were Polish Jews who survived the Holocaust, and almost all the rest of the family was killed, and they eventually made their way to America over a long period of time, and it was the only country in the world where they felt they could rebuild their shattered lives. They were so used to anti-Semitism living in Poland, and they were so happy to be in a place where they didn't have to suffer from that. And that's why they love being Americans. So they would be shocked today, those patriots of mine that were my grandparents, they would be shocked at how little we talk about the things that America needs to do to move the country forward. It seems like every day there's one thing that, you know, some unprovoked thing that comes up on cable or something else. But I think it was right in this case to demonstrate that the House of Representatives wasn't going to tolerate hateful statements like the one that was made.
The president, on his way to Selma, Alabama, about an hour ago, said the Democratic Party is the anti-Israel party. Does he have a point, or is he way off base?
No, he's way off. I think he's way off base. It's absolutely untrue. Look, this is part of what Donald Trump does, and people should understand it. He is, at every turn, because he knows he's fading, he tries to disqualify Democrats in the Democratic Party. So when he hears people talk about, well, we're socialists, then he says, the Democrats are socialists, we'll never have a socialist country. When he hears Democrats talking about abolishing ICE, he says, the Democrats are for open borders. I know that every Democrat in the Senate voted for an immigration bill that I helped write as part of the Gang of Eight in 2013 that had $46 billion of border security. When the president says the Democratic Party is anti-Israel, that's a lie as well. The Democratic Party in Washington supports Israel. What we need to worry about is that a history of bipartisan support for Israel somehow gets turned into a partisan food fight. That is not good for the United States. It's not good for Israel.
You look at a lot of the contenders right now for the nomination, and they're talking about things like the Green New Deal, and they're talking about things like Medicare for All. And are you concerned that that's feeding the Republicans a little too much ammunition? Are some of these rivals going a little too far to the left with the party?
Let me say it another way. Having been a business person and a school superintendent, when I was a kid, we took it as an article of faith that if you worked hard in this country, you could rise in this country. We had the freedom to rise in the United States of America and to take our families with us and the next generation with us. That has not been true for 40 years. And I believe Trump is partly a symptom of that lack of economic mobility combined with the disintegration of some of our democratic institutions. We should be focused on that stuff, you know, that lack of economic mobility. The American people are not prepared to say, oh, okay, well, just because of China, just because of technology, just because of globalization, we have to accept the fact that middle-class families in America can no longer afford things like health care, higher education, early childhood education, housing, that poor people can no longer go from being poor to not poor. They will not accept that, and they know that Washington is broken and corrupt and hasn't been working on those issues for generations. I think that's what this race should be about for Democrats, but more important than that, that's what this race should be for Americans, Democrats and Republicans. How are we going to put this sorry chapter behind us and actually start to reflect the priorities of the American people in our politics in Washington, D.C., instead of the priorities of interest groups and personalities that go on cable television at night? I think that's sort of where we need to be.
Let's leave this with New Hampshire. Is this your first trip here, or have you been here before?
I've been here. I was here once before. Actually, I was here. The last time I was here, I was working for a guy named Dick Celeste, who is the governor of Ohio, and he had come in here to do politics and eggs one day. So it's a great privilege to be back here. I hope to be able to come back many, many times. I've enjoyed the visits so far a lot.
Senator, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
That is Michael Bennett, U.S. Senator from Colorado. You've been listening to On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association.